sorry, not the last case on the docket. The next case on the docket is Keith Jerome Anderson v. Commonwealth. Mr. Mann and Ms. Baumgarten, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Yes, it is. Good afternoon.
Long day, I'm sure. Thank you all for moving my time so I could get something else done, which didn't get accomplished. But anyhow, I represent Keith Anderson on a show cause hearing where his prior sentence from 2011 was revoked. He received the entire eight-year sentence. The basis of the sentence were the allegations that Mr. Anderson was involved in two robberies. The one of the alleged robberies, there was never any type of hearing on it. There was a direct indictment, and then it was now prossed at the first court hearing. The second one was subject to two jury trials. Actually, there were three jury trials. I think there was one. There was a mistrial, and then there were two subsequent ones in February and then in June. Now, the interesting thing about the show cause, in my mind, is that the show cause was issued some 2 years after he was incarcerated on the robbery charges. It was issued after he was, the charge involving the Pierce claim of a robbery was now prossed. It was after the first jury trial on the robbery and possession of firearm, commission of a felony charge, where he was acquitted. Then the Commonwealth, seeing that they were trying to go through the back door, saying, well, let's just go issue a show cause based on the same charges. And then the next charge was in May of that year, where he was found not guilty of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. The case was originally heard, the original trial in 2011 was heard by Judge Covito, but Judge Richard Taylor decided to hear the show cause. We had a hearing on a separate show cause in August. He received a one-year revocation. It's their argument, that during the October 31st right of hearing before Judge Taylor, he was denied the right of confrontation. The only testimony heard was a testimony from two detectives. The victims, there was no showing the victims were unavailable. I think this court, in a recent opinion that has not been cited by either party, is the Cox versus Commonwealth case, which is decided on December 1, 2015. And in that case, this court is a revocation case where they tried to introduce a letter from a probation officer in another jurisdiction to justify a revocation. The lawyer objected to it, and this court said it's a right of confrontation. If you object to it, you got to bring in that probation officer. The same thing here. You've got victims who, during the revocation hearing, I was never able to cross-examine. And one, of course, was the subject of the not guilty pleas. The other one, the case had never been heard whatsoever. So it's certainly our position is that we were denied the right of confrontation under the 14th Amendment. I realize it's a limited right of confrontation, but this court in Cox laid out pretty clearly I believe the Henderson case earlier, which was cited, about what the court has to do. The court has to make a finding that the individuals were unavailable, that there was no such finding in this case, and weigh whether their unavailability, the court can go on based on the reliability of hearsay. But in this case, and we
Captain,
don't have
it. Can you address the 5A12 matter?
Sure. Thank you. I made contemporaneous objections on both detectives that testified on page 64 of the joint appendix. I would submit, Your Honor, first I stated it's hearsay, and then I said I would also submit not only is it hearsay, but best evidence, we don't have the person here to testify on what happened. Again, it's what he reported to the detective. I think that's enough to show the confrontation that we don't have the individual here. And then later on...
What about in your assignment of error, where you referenced the Sixth Amendment?
Well, that was a mistake. It should have been the Fourth. It's the right of confrontation. It's the same thing, but it's actually a due process.
Well, it's not the same thing legally, though.
Well, I understand what you're saying. But I think in the interest of justice, the fact is that if you say, well, it was Sixth Amendment, not the 14th, then, of course, to be frank with you, then I'm looking at a habeas corpus, and he's going to get a new hearing. And I think the court, in the interest of justice, ought to decide this issue. And I think, again, on with Detective Sandlin, I made the same objection in my motion to strike. I made the objection that the individuals weren't here. So I think I have preserved this, you know, the argument, the basis of this argument, that he was denied his right of confrontation. Cases I cited, the Supreme Court cases, are right on point. And I think that the court, I feel this court should hear the issue and make a decision on it, because obviously my client has been locked up for 3.5 years on this matter. He was denied his right of confrontation of these witnesses. And then also the issue of collateral estoppel in this case, I think, is pertinent. And I would cite to the court the Davis case, which is from the Virginia Supreme Court back in October, where the court does recognize...
Counsel, if you provided that to your opposing counsel, was that in brief?
I just did today, because I just got the case. I showed her the cases, and if she has some issue with it, she's more willing to reserve her argument on that. I'd have no problem with that. I would also, Your Honor...
Can you just back a minute on the hearsay issue?
Yes.
As you know, I mean, there's all kinds of case law that says it's much more relaxed standards in a revocation hearing than in a trial.
Correct.
Can you go back a little bit and give me your argument and your as to why hearsay, even if it is hearsay, is not admissible in a revocation hearing?
I'm not saying hearsay can be admissible. Certainly, when you provide a letter from a probation officer, that's clearly hearsay if it's accepted. But as you said in the Cox case, if it's objected to, then you have to provide a reason in the record why it was not, why the court has excused the hearsay. And that's all that the court had to do. And it has to be obviously a valid reason. The Commonwealth never came forward and said, well, these individuals are not available for any reason whatsoever. And so I feel that the due process issue...
Suppose they had given a reason. The reason was they're available, but we think you can still do hearsay in the revocation hearing.
Then the Commonwealth was wrong, because you have under the Supreme Court cases, it says you have a limited right, you have a right to cross-examine witnesses. And certainly I can't cross-examine a police officer who says, this is what so-and-so told me, and that's what this is all about. And in the case where you have this kind of situation, where you have someone found not guilty, then that's a trier of fact. They were the trier of fact. The court can't go back and say, I disagree with the facts, because two juries heard the facts, and in one case... It was never even prosecuted, and so the alleged victim in that case was has never been subject to any kind of testimony under oath. So, and also, there are obviously differences in their testimony, but that's a question of credibility. I don't think we need to go to that in this case. It's clearly that the trier of facts were the jury as to the issues. In this case, unlike the Rezzio case, there was no admission or statement by the defendant that he had done something that would have been the basis for a revocation. In Rezio, he admitted drinking, and there was another case, it might be the Rezio or Henderson, where the individual said he had goods that he knew were stolen, even though he was found not guilty for whatever reason. But there you have admissions. In this case, you have no statements from Mr. Anderson that could be used by that. So all you have is a recitation by the detectives of their investigation and what the, as far as the identification of the individual, they're relying on what was told to them by the two victims. There was no evidence in this case of any stolen goods or property found in Mr. Anderson's presence. There was no evidence when he was arrested that there was a firearm in his presence. So there is nothing to corroborate the testimony of the alleged victims in this case, other than their testimony, and we have that he was the person. But that is, as I said, one of them had been tried and found not guilty, so obviously his testimony was not believable, and the other one was never subject to any cross-examination or any examination under oath by this alleged victim, who obviously didn't want to proceed with the case. So if that were the case, then he certainly should have been brought in and testified. I just rely on my briefs for rest, and I'd like to take my last 3 minutes and 55 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Ms. Baumgartner, before you begin, you were provided with two cases today, two from counsel, right?
Mm-hmm. About 2 minutes before you came back
out. Okay. Should the Commonwealth have any interest in responding to those, you can provide those to the court within 4 days by letter.
Thank you.
And brief letter.
Your Honor, just to be clear, given the impending weather, is that 4 business days or is that 4 calendar days?
Oh, wow. All right, how about... I don't think Mr. Mann would have a problem with by next Wednesday. Is that okay?
That's fine, Judge. I figure she might want to take a snow day, too.
Thanks.
The government never rests, of course, but yeah.
Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. Starting first, Your Honors, with the issue of whether revocation is barred by the results of criminal prosecutions. It's not. There is no case law suggesting it is. Instead, the case law, particularly Marshall, which is controlling, holds that it is not. There's a different standard applied in a criminal prosecution as opposed to in a probation revocation. And therefore, it's not at all clear here that the jury simply didn't believe the victim. We don't know why the jury acquitted, except that they found at least one of the elements was not met beyond a reasonable doubt. The court here had no duty to find a violation of probation beyond a reasonable doubt. The fact that Marshall made admissions that supported his probation revocation is simply a distinction without a difference. It's one of the pieces of evidence of his guilt, just as here there was a great deal of evidence of Mr. Anderson's guilt in robbing both Mr. Blackwell and Mr. Pierce.
You're talking about, for example, things like keys in his pocket.
The keys in his pocket, the ballistics evidence. The fact that he committed very similar crimes. The MO here was extremely similar. He approached the victims about a block apart within 15 minutes of each other and got their attention with a ruse. With one, he was asking for a cigarette light. With the other, he was petting his dog, brought out a gun, put them on the ground to pat them down. And those are very specific descriptions from two completely uninvolved witnesses. In addition, those are specific actions. In addition, they both gave very similar descriptions. The cornrows, the white shirt, the white shorts, the white shoes, the scraggly beard. Mr. Pierce also said he was wearing gold fronts on his teeth, which were found in his pocket when he was stopped. So there is corroboration both between the two victims and with the ballistics evidence, the keys, and the gold fronts. And also the fact that the defendant was arrested within two blocks of the crimes wearing those clothes. Moving on to the issue of whether or not the court erred by admitting hearsay. First of all, as I argued on brief, this was not preserved at trial. He objected on state law grounds, which was confirmed in the colloquy with the court regarding his objection. And now he's arguing the confrontation clause. It's not the same thing. And I think...
Well, he's actually arguing both.
Well, he is, but there is not the same prohibition on hearsay in a revocation hearing that there would be in a criminal trial. And the defendant simply had no Sixth Amendment rights at a probation revocation hearing. So it's not, well, it should have been 14th Amendment, it should have been Sixth Amendment. Those are indeed, as you said, Your Honor, different bodies of law. And the Mowbray and Herring cases are about whether the assignments of error are inherently inspecific if they don't say exactly what the problem is. Here we have an assignment of error that says there's a problem, and then the body of the brief argues a different problem. The finger is laid on the wrong issue. And to the extent that the defendant argues that, well, it would be a habeas matter, so you might as well address it now, obviously habeas is a different standard.
This is a revocation hearing.
This is a revocation hearing, and habeas requires prejudice. There's no prejudice here, in large part because the defendant himself admitted all the transcripts from the trial. So to the extent that he's complaining about hearsay, he admitted those transcripts, which are treated the same as substantively hearsay, and included all the same evidence that was testified to by the detectives.
Is there any argument to be made that it would be in a different context, a written form versus an oral form?
I don't think there is an argument to be made, except the context, obviously, of the transcripts is it was cross-examined at trial. And so, if anything, it's hearsay, but it's much more involved testimony. It's more detailed testimony. So what we're left with then is if it is in fact preserved, the 14th Amendment objection, the test is reliability. And as I argued on brief, there are many indicia of reliability, including the fact that they corroborate each other, the fact that both reports were made within half an hour, I believe, of the robberies, that they are partially corroborated by physical evidence, and that they both victims did face liability for false reporting if they had made false reports to the police. So even if the court were to find that that issue were preserved, there was sufficient indicia of reliability to allow this testimony.
The court did not go through the Henderson test, though.
The court didn't go through the Henderson test, but there is case law cited in the brief that when the court permits that evidence in, they are inherently finding that it is reliable.
Your position that the admission of the transcripts would basically correct that issue in and of itself, since the defendant introduced that?
Absolutely. Now, admittedly, Pierce wasn't in those transcripts. The Pierce robbery was not in those transcripts because he did not cooperate with the prosecution. However, the Blackwell robbery alone is sufficient. Having the robbery would be sufficient. Having a gun on him would be sufficient because there was the exchange of gunfire that was heard by an ear witness, and there were ballistics from two different types of gun recovered at the scene. While the defendant argues that there was only one type of shell casing recovered from the scene, there was an unspent bullet also recovered from the scene from under the Volvo. And that corroborated Mr. Blackwell's testimony that the defendant had racked his gun, expelling a bullet while they were standing by the Volvo. So while there is, in fact, only one type of shell casing, there are ballistics indicating there were two types of guns present at the scene, one of which belonged to the defendant. That alone would be enough to revoke his probation.
So you're saying that if error were to be assumed, and I know you don't concede that, but if error were to be assumed, as it relates to Pierce, it's harmless, given...
Correct. Correct. And then I think the final argument from the defendant is that there wasn't sufficient cause to revoke his probation, which is essentially a weight of the evidence argument. The review here is merely for abuse of discretion, and I think the defendant argues this point by repeatedly arguing facts that are somewhat mischaracterized as far as only one type of shell casing. I just addressed that. Also arguing that there's no incriminating evidence. The Volvo keys in and of themselves are incriminating evidence because they tie him to the car that was used in the attempted abduction. And then there's regular arguments on briefs that there was no corroboration, and yet there were independent victims. There was the defendant's presence and appearance, and there was also the ear witness. There was a great deal of corroboration in this case. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mann?
Yes. Regarding the claim about the additional evidence, I would cite to the court page 95 of the appendix, where they talk about the firearm that Mr. Blackwell claims to have been seen. It was, they said, he said there it was a small revolver, small caliber weapon, yes. And I said, so you found no shells or shell casings from a small caliber weapon at the scene? No, I did not. So the claim of this unspent shell found in the area is just bogus. It has no relation to any firearm, which was never found on Mr. Anderson's person.
But and a revolver is not going to eject shell casings to begin with.
Correct. Thank you, Judge. And furthermore, the issue of the Volvo has really is another sort of red herring, because there's no, the only evidence of a Volvo is Mr. Not Pierce, the other gentleman's claim that this took place near a black Volvo. Well, the black Volvo, and my client had keys to the black Volvo. Well, they never found anything in the black Volvo related to this crime. No guns, no shell casing similar to a small revolver, nothing of that nature. So the fact he had keys to the black Volvo means he had parked his car there. He was in the neighborhood. But that doesn't have any relationship that proves that he committed these robberies. Again, we get back to the testimony of the victims, of which the victim was the one that had the firearm in this case. So I think to say that there was a differentiation in the testimony as to the type of clothing that they identified and the clothing Mr. Anderson wore. But so that just goes to the fact that the claims from Judge Taylor that, and I'm looking at page 123-124, that there was physical evidence such as keys and two robberies on the same date within close proximity. He never states in his statement for the reasons for the revocation that he relied upon the transcripts of the prior trials, that he looked at them, that he reviewed them, that he disagreed with the jury verdict. He never made any such comments in his reasons for the revocation. It was simply the circumstances, which he says alleged robberies take place. I would say that there was no credible evidence that Mr. Anderson, who was found at the scene, was the person who committed those. When the testimony from Mr. Blackwell was disregarded by the jury, we don't go to a jury and say what was the reason why you found somebody not guilty. This was a case on the merits. It wasn't because he for any other reason. And so I think we have to look at that and say they were the trier of facts. They knew what happened. And I think the court denied the right of confrontation in this case, however way you want to phrase it, and that the matter should be reversed. Thank you.
Appreciate
your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. If you